Morning, Leslie. Skiing and riding conditions remain five-star in the backcountry, though, of course, the southerly aspects will have a breakable crust that will soon soften. The overnight temperatures are a bit warmer than they were 24 and 48 hours ago, and with direct sun and heating, of course, those will soften up and even be unstable on the steepest sunny aspects today, so the danger will rise to moderate for the wet avalanche activity on the northern end of the compass. I describe it probably best as spooky, where we are hearing about pockets of persistent slabs that are pulling out 1 to 3, even 4 feet deep, just in shallower snowpack areas and more prominent along the Park City ridgeline and in the upper reaches of Mill Creek and in the shallower snowpack areas. Also along the periphery in the Ogden area mountains out of bounds there, we heard of a large avalanche that was triggered just along the northern end of the backcountry portions of the snow basin area, and a large natural that we heard about that came out of the northeast chute of Elk Point. That's a notorious avalanche path just up the street from Sundance there in Aspen Grove. It was the tragic site of the triple fatality about a decade or more ago. That was a large natural that ran about 3,000 feet, likely yesterday. But overall, we have a moderate danger, but it's moderate with teeth. These are not benign avalanche conditions, but it's not everywhere and it's not widespread, but just pockets of these avalanches pulling out. So overall, moderate danger for southerly aspects with the wet, and then moderate danger for the low probability, high consequence avalanches at the mid and upper elevation northerly aspects. I'd advise people to check the website, UtahAvalancheCenter.org, before they head out into the backcountry today.
Okay, Drew, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Leslie.
KPCW News Time 8. Well, the Summit County Council had a pretty easygoing meeting yesterday. On the phone with a recap, I have County Council member Doug Clyde. Good morning, Doug.
Good morning, Leslie.
So regarding the legislative update, what do you think about the bill to ban bans? You heard from Jana Young and Jamie Bracken thinking that it may not get out of the House.
Well, as usual, we're hopeful that that's the case. You know, I think that we feel it was a misguided effort to attempt to limit the power of cities and counties to determine their own policies, and so we'd be most grateful if that didn't get passed.
Yeah, if it was not struck down, would you favor the county adopting something similar?
We're certainly looking into it. Yeah, we propose to take a look at that in detail, and we're going to look through and coordinate with Park City to find out what their experiences were in that area. And then this bag ban came up, we haven't looked at it since then. We've just been worried about whether it was going to pass or not.
Okay. Let's see. What's your impression of the opioid problem and the legal action that's being considered there?
Well, the county attorney has been looking into that for in some detail for some time now. We heard from our potential counsel on that. We passed a resolution that indicated that we were going to take legal action as a county on that issue, and it's of course very complicated. It's much like the tobacco issue. There appears to be some smoking gun letters that have come up from people's files that indicate that there may be considerable liability on the part of the providers and the manufacturers.
All right. Let's see. So you've made the decision to move forward with it then?
That's correct. It'll be a constantly evolving effort, but we've made the decision as a county to move forward.
Yeah. And how much is the county willing to spend?
Well, it's all going to be done on a contingency basis. There'll be no out-of-pocket for the county.
All right. Let's see. There was also a bond for $22 million on road projects. You went ahead and approved that bond financing?
Yeah, that was actually approved in a previous meeting, but the purpose of last night's meeting was just a requirement of state law to hold a public hearing on that, which we did, and there were no public comments. So we're moving forward with that for everybody's benefit. What that is that, as you probably know, we passed a tax on both for transportation and for transit last year. We're in the process of collecting that now. And what this bond is doing is simply allowing us to leverage the next few years of that tax. In other words, we're passing a bond that represents the amount of tax that we'll collect in the next 4 years. That'll give us an aggregate amount of money that we can apply to some of the large projects that we're looking at.
Yeah. Now, are there projects in South Summit that you want to see?
Certainly, South Summit has some things on the books. One of which is the park and ride for the bus system, and then also we've got a trails project that has been partially completed for a little over a decade now, that connects Oakley to Camas, that we would also like to see finished up and be part of that project as well.
So, how many cars in this Camas park and ride?
Good question. I don't have an answer for that off the top of my head. I just know that it has been a successful program, and that some of the people, of course, who go there are not parking and riding. They're walking or riding their bike to the transit center.
Right. So this would pay for the property. And
it would pay for, it would pay for the property, it would pay for paving, it would pay for shelters, those sorts of things.
Yeah, and this is where people pick up this Camas connector that takes them from basically downtown Camas to, what, the Park City area?
Both Park City and Kimball Junction, yeah.
Okay. Hey, wanted to ask you about something from last week, the updated housing assessment. An estimated demand of some more than 400 affordable units a year. Can we build that, and if so, how?
Well, I think that's still a work in progress. First of all, and that report is very complicated. We're in the process of reviewing it now that we've actually had it delivered to us. But the short answer on 400 units a year. Is no. It doesn't correspond to what our general plan says. Our general plan talks about integrating affordable housing. So if we were to do something as radical as that, we would first of all have to revise our general plan and then decide where the units were going to be built and how they were going to be built. But those sort of numbers speak to large apartment complexes like you would see in some sort of urban renewal project, and I don't think that's what our community is looking for.
So you would not then go along with building units taller than the code limit of 3 stories?
Oh, I don't think that's the question. I think the question is first of all, affordable housing, like any other land use issue, needs to be integrated into our overall planning. And part of the first step, of course, is to decide what your needs are and then decide how you're going to satisfy those needs. And the responsibility of the county is to do just simply that, to identify them and then to facilitate. We are not responsible for building affordable housing. Now, that said, we've made great strides in producing affordable housing with our agreement, for example, with the Canyons, in which we just went through a modification of their plan to produce 1,000 pillows, roughly, down at the base of the Canyons for their affordable housing needs. The county is largely responsible for the construction of the Peace House, which, of course, speaks to some of the more needy portions of our population or vulnerable portions of our population. So the Peace House project is underway. That's over 20 units. We also have, for example, we just facilitated a bond for For the Olympic Park, in which they will be providing some residences for people who are training at the park. So, you know, we are making progress on affordable housing. We, of course, also have the Klein Dahl property, which we purchased roughly about a year ago. So there are lots of projects in the works, but none that speak to building anything like large apartment complexes that 400 number would imply.
Yeah, but what about the fact that we have hundreds of lower-priced market units being built just 10 minutes from Park City and Wasatch County and Todd Hollow and Black Rock? I mean, shouldn't those be considered as...
I think that's one of the things that we're going to refine and look at when we get into the details of this plan. You know, for example, the resorts have been busing employees up to the ski areas during the winter months for you know, a couple of decades now. We don't see that as a bad thing necessarily. There's you know, there are people who live in Salt Lake and down in the valley and other locations who a member of their family wants to work at the resort. There's nothing wrong with them being bused up to those locations.
Yeah, but I'm just wondering if maybe there was some public, better public transportation to this area in Wasatch County that, you know, it would help with, or even some commerce in that area, so they didn't have to keep driving into Summit County.
Yeah, we're working on a bus system to Salt Lake. We are beginning discussions with Wasatch County. Albeit they are just in their incipient forms, but our primary target right now in our joint transportation management authority has been to expand our system down into Salt Lake Valley, and we're looking to do that with some of the newer Proterra electric buses.
All right, let's see. What about Promontory? Do you favor requiring them to come up with a plan to build their required 35 units of employee housing?
I think in general the council looks at that as an agreement that is unmet and that they're required to perform on. We found ourselves in a place where nothing had transpired on that for quite some time, probably mainly due to the economic slowdown, and now they're looking to do some new projects, and so it came up about, well, okay, where are they relative to being in compliance? And I think at this point, we believe that they are insufficient in their approach to their affordable housing requirement at this point. The language is quite vague. It requires them to produce a plan. We've asked them to produce a plan and to come back to us with a rationale as to why that plan meets their requirements.
And finally, can you give us a preview of what's going to be discussed at the council retreat on Monday?
Yes. In general, we're simply going to try and sharpen up and give better direction to staff on our critical priorities. I think that's the sum of it. I do have a pending homework requirement where I'm to prepare for that meeting, and frankly, I've not done my homework yet, so I can't give you more detail.
Give me an idea. What are Summit County's critical priorities? Do they match Park City's transportation, sustainability, housing?
Yes, we're of course all working on similar items, you know, such as traffic and transit and affordable housing is in there as well. That's a priority of ours, but also completing our master planning processes, both updating our general plans and updating our development codes, are major priorities for us. And that's one of the things we're going to talk about is how do we continue to move those things forward. The problem that we have is that while while both planning commissions, both the East and the West, have been involved in trying to advance their plans for both general plan and for the development code, they constantly get sidetracked by other projects. Sometimes they are things that we direct them to do. For example, the redo of the Canyons spa was something that the county took an active interest in because it helped us deliver affordable housing. Now, that took a considerable amount of time for the Planning Commission to work through that process. The other thing that happens is that we get appeals. You know, we've currently got the appeal on the Coley School and the appeal on Woodward. Those, of course, take substantial time from the Planning Commission and then take time away from the County Council as well. So those are the sort of distractions that we have to manage if we're going to move our plans forward. And so part of the subjects that we will talk about.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention, Doug?
I think I'm good. Thank you.
Thank you. Summit County Council Member Doug Clyde. This is the final day of the annual Utah legislative session in the studio to look at some of the issues that have been discussed this 45 days. I have the chairperson of the Summit County Republican Party, Brantley Eason, along with Deanna Rhodes. She serves as a committee person for the Summit County Democrats. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, let's start with gun legislation. Steve Handy's House Bill 483, this would take guns away from the severely mentally ill. Last I heard on Monday, it failed to get out of a House committee. Brantley, I mean, some see it more of a gun confiscation effort than a public safety message. As we try to see some sort of gun sense legislation passed, why does something like this not have support, do you think?
Well, the way the legislature is going, obviously they're really busy, have a lot going on. I doubt that it'll get out of, we'll get to the floor for a vote as well. This legislation talks about taking guns away from residents or from family members who feel threatened. And so I don't think there's necessarily anything wrong with that. If I'm at my house and my wife, children, whoever has a gun and I feel threatened, then I should be able to live the way I want and not feel threatened. So the way this bill works, it would remove that weapon for a small period of time in order to make sure that threat's not there. So that's what we're looking at.
But it doesn't seem to have a lot of
Not a lot of momentum.
Republican support.
Not a lot of momentum in the legislature. I haven't heard exactly why this hasn't picked up. I think other priorities have come up, and so it just hasn't gained traction yet.
And Deanna, I mean, is that what Democrats see as the problem, that every bill dealing with guns is seen as taking away gun rights?
So first of all, I just want to say I'm kind of excited to see that this was actually proposed, whether it does get a lot of traction or not. I think it's the fact that a Republican has actually proposed this. So there has to be a little bit of support there. And whether I want to admit it or not, that's going to have to be kind of who does create that groundswell. And so I think it's, you know, it's a recognition that something does need to be done, and so starting to explore it. I think possibly it's just a little too late in the game to really gain the traction and the momentum. So hopefully this is something they can take to the interim session and really flesh out and make it something that can be good legislation for our state.
A foot in the door here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's look at the Our Schools Now initiative. It appears to be a compromise being negotiated that would take about $100 million out of the transportation subsidy coming from the general fund and put a gas tax ballot measure of 10 cents a gallon to cover that shortfall. Discussion to come up with another $200 million by unfreezing the tax levy, which would put more property taxes into the education coffers. I mean, what do you guys think about this compromise? Grantley?
Well, you're exactly right. So what it does, it basically rearranges taxes. So it increases the gas tax. And the gas tax fund, instead of going to the general fund, they'll go straight to transportation, which frees up money in the general fund, which will be allocated to education. I think it's a good workaround. From what I've heard, the folks with Our Schools Now are interested and happy that something's being proposed. And so I think it's a decent compromise.
Yeah. How about How about you, Deanna?
I would agree. I think it's a good compromise, and that's what a compromise is, right? Everyone coming to the table and trying to work together. I would pose the question, why did we have to have a ballot initiative and so many ballot initiatives to get some conversation at the table? So that's a little bit what I would like to examine. But as far as the actual legislation, I think it's, you know, it's a good effort, and I like seeing that people are coming together and really trying to make a difference here.
Yeah. And I guess that is a compromise because our schools now talked about putting $700 million into education. This would bring about $300 million. So is that, I guess that's what makes a good compromise.
Nobody's happy.
Medical marijuana. Any idea what's happening here on this?
So there have been a couple of bills, House Bill 195 and 197, that have addressed some of the, I won't say loopholes, but some of the gaps in the initiative. 195 talks about who it's for as far as the right to try for terminally ill patients. And then 197 talks about who actually is over it. So Department of Agriculture is going to be over cannabis. So I believe both of those have passed both houses.
Oh, okay. So there was some concern, I think, that we had lawmakers very opposed to the ballot effort, you know, basically just a slippery slope to approving legalizing marijuana. Does this then, do either of those then negate the results of the ballot initiative? Because there was some talk about that, that we had legislation that would undo anything that was brought about by the initiative process.
I don't think they negate per se. It's a tricky initiative considering that cannabis is still illegal federally. And so it'll come down to the federal courts at some point. So this is just to fill some holes within the initiatives. And then once it does end up going to the federal courts, we'll see what happens there.
And then from the Democratic point of view, Deanna, I mean, I think this, like many of the ballot initiatives, just concerned that lawmakers aren't listening to their constituents. And I guess the question is, would that ever change? Because we've got such a gerrymandered state that it's impossible to have other than Republicans in either of the House.
So what you're saying as impossible, I actually see as a great opportunity, and it's a great window to the fact that tomorrow is opportunity. Anyone really can come out and file to run for office, and there's a lot of offices that are open. You know, our senator here is retiring, so that's an open seat that can be run unopposed, potentially. And so, you know, I think that a lot of times we have to recognize that we have to make strides where we can make strides. And so coming out and running for office or supporting someone who is running for office is a great opportunity to really change what that legislature looks like. I would contest that at the moment our legislature isn't very representative because of not just party, but just the diversity that I see lacks on the state level.
Yeah. So do the Democrats, are they going to put together a slate of candidates for all of the open offices?
Yeah, so actually, I'm really proud to say, I'll let them, you know, file themselves and make their own personal announcements, but I'm really proud to say that there is a Democrat running in every race in our area.
Yeah, how about the same for the Republicans? It's a big race for the Senate district, yeah?
It is. Right now, I think there's about 7 Republicans that have said that they will collect signatures. Talking to different candidates, my guess is you'll probably see 3 or 4 of those not actually file as candidates, and you'll probably see 1 or 2 that jump in as well. So it's going to be Senate District 26 is going to be a busy race.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. Because we saw recently a small percentage of the state GOP basically basically just wanting to do away with the signature gathering process and basically kind of throwing you out of the party if you didn't agree with them. How what's your reaction to
so that was one of the bylaws passed by the State Central Committee. It was called by 25%, which is part of the bylaw rules. And what it basically says, it shouldn't affect anyone this cycle. And going forward, it just says that the state party would like to have their candidates elected through the caucus convention system.
And how do you feel about that?
Well, the state party is, their preference is the caucus convention system. And so as a basically subset of the state party, we as a county party, that's what we prefer.
Yeah. Why don't they like the signature collection process? Because when you think about running for office, by having more opportunities to get on the ballot, it's bigger and more open as opposed to very closed and small.
Well, the caucus system is you elect representatives, state delegates from your precinct or general neighborhood. And so as it basically serves as a microcosm for the system as a whole. We elect our representatives from our different districts. So as the state party, you represent a state delegate from your specific district. And it's just the way things have worked out previously, and the state likes it.
Yeah, but when you have 76% of all Utahns supporting a second way to get on the ballot, it seems to me that you're not being very representative of your constituents.
Well, you have to look at the party as a specific organization. I don't see the government coming in and telling other businesses who they can have represent them, or nonprofits saying you can have these specific people on your board, or you need to change your bylaws to have certain people or on your board. So it's a little bit of a disconnect there.
Yeah. I just want to point out that the caucus system seems to preclude many people from participating. I mean, when we look at John Curtis, Congressional District 3, mm-hmm. he was elected to that office to fulfill Jason Chaffetz's vacancy. He didn't make it through the Republican convention, though, and now here he is mm-hmm. in the office, and he only got that because of the signature collection process. Mm-hmm.
That's true, and that's what we have now. We've got the two-path method, and it can be confusing for a lot of people, knowing which way you either run as a candidate or how people are elected. I think it would be better if we went back to one specific system, just so it's clear for everyone.
Yeah, when we've got, of course, Senate Bill 54, which mm-hmm. allows the two processes, but it sounds like there's some effort to undo that. We've got this guy. Do you know who he is? This Dave Bateman apparently paid off the debt that the GOP went into
Correct.
To fight at Senate mm-hmm. Bill 54, and now wants to say how to run things. I mean,
he reimbursed the party because he believes so much in the caucus convention system, and so he reimbursed the party for the legal bills that have been incurred for the lawsuit that came up fighting SB 54.
Right. So is that doesn't seem like that's the way things are supposed to be, to have somebody pay for something and then be able to dictate how things are going to be run. I mean, that's what it feels like it's happening here.
No, he's not dictating anything by any means. He made a donation to the party, and the state party looked at the outstanding legal bills, and Dave Bateman said that he believes so much in the caucus convention system that he would donate to the party in order to pay off those bills. So he's just a believer.
And the Democrats in Indiana would continue to support the two process.
Yeah, I think, we have always represented ourselves as the party of the people and giving them opportunity and whatever that looks like. I certainly can't begin to comment on the GOP and what they want to do and how what's best for them. But I would say, looking at some other state races across the country that's happening right now, the DCCC coming in and really trying to overthrow some of the candidates that are being kind of highly supported by the community is probably not going in their best interest. So just looking at some examples, you could take a look there, but I would never begin to dictate what you guys want to do with your party.
I wanted to mention real quickly, Senate Bill 192. This is the one that would do away with Park City's ban on plastic bags in big retail outlets. Have Democrats had any luck in convincing lawmakers not to do this?
So from And actually, this is really interesting to me that it's even coming up as an issue because, you know, this summer, meeting with my representative, Representative McQuinn, which is a lot of representatives for the area here, 54, you know, he really said that when we passed this as city council, several people approached him and asked him if he was going to be fighting against it on a state level. And he said no. And from what I understand, he's trying to gather votes to kind of shut that down, which I appreciate because for me, you know, again, it's really difficult to me with a party that typically says they don't want government interference from their higher ups, from their federal level. They on the state level, they're turning around and, you know, basically having government overreach on this city and county level. And that really disturbs me just from a principle of how the system and what they stand for. And I have to wonder if, you know, the senator that's proposed this, if there's a reason that is maybe not in the community's best interest to be proposing this.
And then, Brantley, what about Summit County Republicans? I mean, do you agree with Tim Quinn's philosophy?
Absolutely.
They may not agree with banning bags, but it's certainly Park City's prerogative to do so.
Absolutely. Government should take place in the most local areas possible. We're looking at it. I reached out to a couple of representatives as well and asked them to shoot down the bill if possible. And so hopefully government stays local. And that's the plan.
Okay. Again, if people are interested in running for one of the many offices available, both on a county and state level, school board as well, the filing window opens tomorrow o'clock, 9 o'clock, and then runs through Thursday the 15th at 5 p.m. People, what, need just to show up at the county courthouse to do that?
That's correct. Show up to the county courthouse, talk to the clerk, fill out your paperwork, and pay the filing fee, and then you will be a candidate.
Okay, and we'll be bringing those to you as people file. So, again, thanks for your time, Brantley,
thank you.
Indiana. It's 8:48. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher with the Park City Community Education Department offering dozens of classes for kids through seniors. In the studio to tell us about some of them, I have Jane Tolley, the Community Education Manager for the Park City School District, along with one of the class instructors about how to publish children's books, Katie Mullally. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Katie, let's start with you. The class that you'll be teaching is self-publishing your children's book. When is this going to be held?
It starts next Tuesday, the 13th. No, the 12th.
The 13th.
13th, thank you.
13th.
The 13th. It's two nights, the 13th and the 20th. It's over at the high school. It goes from 6:30 to 8:30 at night.
Okay. And what do you think people get out of it by attending those two nights?
What I hope they get out of it is, first of all, whether or not they actually want to go on this journey of self-publishing their children's book. I always start the class with saying this can either be advice or a warning. And to really learn all of the things that I spent the last 4 years researching, discovering, learning the hard way, I feel like I've compiled a lot of that into this, you know, four-hour class so that people really have a good foundation with which to start their own self-publishing journey, adventure.
So how difficult is it to self-publish? And is the biggest thing that you just got to put your money on the line?
You know what's funny is the biggest thing, I always thought the writing was the hardest part. No, that was really easy. The publishing part, the actual steps you take for publishing, that's easy as well. The hardest part is, yes, the money, because it's a big investment, especially when you're doing hardcover books like mine. You do have to put in a lot of money and you sit on a lot of inventory. But the hardest part is the marketing and distribution, because unless people know about your books, they can't buy them. It doesn't matter how great they are. It's still the marketing is the hardest part. And so it's the challenging part is the marketing.
So you need to have some understanding of public relations work then, huh?
Yes, and you have to really be the type to put yourself out there, because a lot of us that are writers and creatives, we tend to be a bit more introverted. But when you have to constantly be on and constantly say, oh, hi, yeah, I'm a children's book author, and hand out your cards and be engaging all the time, it can be a challenge, but it's also rewarding because you're promoting your own passion.
Okay. Jane, let's talk a little bit about some of the other classes. Some of the most popular ones are what, the computer and fitness classes and cooking classes?
Yes. Actually, the most popular class that we offer is babysitting training. And we have one coming up on Friday. And we have a few spaces available, which is unusual. So if your child is age 11 and up, sign up.
All right. And you have what? Just somebody teaching some basic first aid?
Well, it's the Red Cross babysitting course. and they do first aid, and they also talk about marketing, you know, their skills and what to do and how to handle every situation. And our instructor, Crystal Sacco, has been teaching this for a number of years, and it's something that a lot of kids have taken, and it's important to know that.
All right. And what are some of the other classes that you're excited about?
We have with coming up in April, this is a new class called Quick and Easy Hairstyles for Girls. It's a parent-child workshop. So basically, you bring your child and learn how to do quick and easy hairstyles with Jennifer from Cookie Cutters in Salt Lake. So, yeah. So a pro's teaching you how to do it. And then, you know, that'll save you some time and tears in the morning. We also have a lot of our cooking classes coming up. So we have fresh pasta, pasta sauces, more pasta sauces, Beyond Marinara, Asian Fusion, Spring Soups, Gourmet Cantina. And we're going to be starting our second round of fitness, which will get you through the beginning of the summer. So if you take Pilates, yoga, then you know, you'll be all set to go in your shorts and your swimmy suit.
Okay. And you also bring it back Tai Chi. You've got both the beginner and advanced.
Mm-hmm. And that has been really popular with Wyatt. It's full right now, but, you know, if you have done Tai Chi in the past, you're qualified to take Tai Chi advanced. It's, you know, we're friendly that way.
Okay. Any other classes that you want to highlight? What about the dancing classes?
We have swing going with Andrea Hale-Tatton. So that's in progress right now. We're going to have cha-cha coming up. And in the past, we've done like one-night workshops, and we've switched that up to be like a series of four dance classes. So you know, get a little more in-depth into what she has to offer. And she's highly qualified teacher. She's okay. Been on Dancing with the Stars, and So You Think You Can Dance, and she's won international competitions.
She's good.
Yeah, she's good and friendly, too.
And how do you get ideas for what classes to offer?
From current events, people call and want to teach. People refer others to me. So it just depends.
And if somebody is interested in teaching, that would be the best way to just get a hold of you. And
yes.
Okay. And
yes.
Then how do people register for Katie's class or any of these others that you've mentioned?
There's a few ways. You can register online at pcschools.us, and then you just click on the compass icon on the main page, and it'll take you to the leisure learning site, and you can register that way. You can give me a call and register over the phone. And my phone number is 435-615-0215. Or you can send me an email at jtoly@pcschools.us. jtoly@pcschools.us. Or you can come to my office. I'm at the district office. So
okay. Katie, yeah. Jane, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Thanks, Leslie.
And in the studio with me, with an update from the Youth Sports Alliance, Executive Director Emily Fisher. Good morning.
Good morning.
So before we get the final Park City Nation wrap-up, just talk a little bit, tell us what Park City Nation is.
Sure, absolutely. So Park City Nation, after the 2014 Olympics, we realized that if Park City competed as its own nation, it would have been very competitive in the medals race. And so for 2018, we started tracking Olympians that are coming from Park City. So we kind of have two categories. We call them homegrown, so athletes that either grew up here, went through the school district, or went through our club system. So some people move here just for our club system, or athletes that live here now. So, for example, the Fletcher brothers grew up in Steamboat Springs, but they both own homes here and so are part of our hometown now. So Park City Nation is homegrown and hometown athletes, and it was a total of 54 athletes for the 2018 games.
Wow. And then again, from all of those different categories.
From all of those different categories, yeah. And we had pretty much all of the disciplines represented. So it was not just one sport. It was sort of all the disciplines, all the sports.
And I think that's probably what, out of just over 200, huh?
So, yeah, it was 20% of Team USA was Park City Nation.
Wow, that's impressive. I mean, and I think you had figured out if it was a its own country or something.
If it was its own country. So we did. We won two bronze medals and one silver medal. So Britta Sigourney and Izzy Atkins won bronze medals, and Alex Ferreira won a silver medal. So we would have finished 24th in the medal count, just behind Australia, but ahead of Slovenia.
Okay. And we're going to celebrate Park City Nation with an Olympic parade. When and where is this going to be?
Yes. So April 6th, mark your calendars, April 6th at 5 p.m. So it's the Friday before spring break. So we will have the parade of athletes down Main Street. We love our parades. And then we will have an athlete autograph signing, a barbecue and a beer garden at Bridge Street Cafe. And then there will be a concert. We're actually partnering with the Thin Air Festival. So they will have their end of Thin Air concert at the bottom of Main Street at 7 p.m. And it is Citizen Cope. So very exciting. It should be a really fun afternoon and a great community event.
I remember we did this a few years ago. I think it was on a Saturday. But yeah, it was a lot of fun. And you had a good turnout of the athletes. Do we know who's committed so far?
So after the Olympics, the Olympians scatter. And so they're all still competing on World Cup Tour, and they're sort of scattered all over the globe. So we are slowly getting RSVPs in. And so hopefully we will have a whole roster to announce here soon. And we'll come back on the radio with the city and talk about the parade a little bit more as we get closer.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
We have our Get Out and Play programs. We have our last couple of sessions coming up. We have our mountain bike and bouldering sessions. And we also have our Activate. We have a bunch of sessions coming up. We have a CPR day. And we also have added curling. So we want to have a curling representative as part of Park City Nation in 2022. So Treasure and Ecker will have curling sessions coming up.
Okay. Emily, thanks for coming by.
You're welcome.
It's Emily Fisher, Executive Director of the Youth Sports Alliance. It's the Local News Hour on KPCW.